Welcome back in the studio. A 21st century look at history's greatest rock albums.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
guitar
three.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, Pete Townshend rejoins us for part two of one of the most significant albums of the last half century.
Rock and roll is about the moment that you become alone, the moment when you grow up, the moment when you leave home. Or the reference I always give now, currently, is that East of Eden moment where Jimmy Dean is facing his dad across the room and he's about to leave, and it's all in his face. He can't speak. It's like a great kind of My Generation stuttering moment. He can't say what he wants to say, but interestingly enough, neither can his father. His father can spill out invective, call his son a creep, tell him he's got to get a job, you know. And then there's this thing with the mother, you know, who wants everything to be right. That moment is what rock and roll is about. Whether you stay or whether you go, you are from that moment alone. You will never ever not be alone again, and that's what rock and roll is about.
Listening to you, I get the music. Gazing at you, I get the heat.
Hi, this is Pete Townshend in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 2.
If there is a pivotal point in the story of Tommy, The Who's 1969 rock opera, which Rolling Stone magazine ranks at number 96 on their top 500 albums of all time, then it has to be the song Pinball Wizard. It's here that we begin to see Pete Townshend's deaf, dumb, and blind boy, not simply as tragic victim, but suddenly as pop culture savant. The song Pinball Wizard turns out to be one of the last songs written by Townshend, because after hearing much of Tommy as a work in progress, a young music critic for The Guardian newspaper, Nick Cohn, suggested a critical story element to composer Pete Townshend.
It was a fairly spontaneous piece, which I think is probably why it's so good. It also came towards the end of the album. We delivered the album for review, preview, to a friend of ours called Nick Cohen, who was a writer for the Manchester Guardian. He was very young. I think he was only about 20 years old. He was the youngest pop writer in England at the time, working for a conventional newspaper. And he hadn't really liked Tommy, and I was very disappointed. I expected him to like it, and he said it's okay, you know. And we went out, and we were, you know, shooting pinball in some arcade somewhere. I said to him, you know, if Tommy was a pinball player, you know, would you be more receptive to the idea? And he turned around to me and he said, yeah. So I went home and I wrote the song. And then I replayed him the piece with all of the references to Tommy, rather than just being a spiritual leader, being a pinball player. So the pinball became a metaphor for the life of a rock star, or even the life of a guru. And Nick said, it's great, it works. He said, it's not just great because you've done this for me, you know, and I will give it a good review. He said, what it's actually done is it's add some colour and some real pop to this otherwise really quite boring idea about kind of the spiritual life, you know. He actually found the idea quite kind of depressing, and he felt that that when I introduced pinball, and I wrote the song in an hour or 2 hours. I went back and sort of knocked it out and did a two-track demo, acoustic guitar with an electric guitar overdub. Took it to the studio and we recorded it, and very, very simple song to do.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball. Always it's got such a supporter.
never seen him fall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball. I thought I was the body table king, but I just handed my pinball crown to him. Disciples needed him, and he just does the rest. He's not crazy, flipping fingers, never seen him fall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
At the time of its release, sounding twice as powerful as anything to ever come out of the AM radio, the crackling electricity of The Who's Pinball Wizard combined Pete Townshend's power chords with his now-signature acoustic guitar strumming. I asked Pete if his furious acoustic guitar technique was pure accident or sheer genius.
No, I think genius. I think if there's anything that I can claim in my life as genius, it's that way I play on that song. I think it was a discovery of a technique which is actually very, very complex. It's much more complex than it readily appears. It's about the way that you hold the pick. The pick has to float in midair. It mustn't be held. It mustn't be held stiffly. It has to be float between the fingers so that the strokes on the guitar are completely feather-light. And, of course, the danger is that while the pick is floating, you drop it. So the technique is to develop a technique where the pick is floating gently between the fingers, but you never drop it. And once you can actually master that, you can do anything on the acoustic guitar. You can do 64th strokes, whatever you want to do. Almost as though you were just, you know, letting your finger go into kind of overload. And that became... And I think that was something that I actually pursued and made work and became... And when I fell off my bike, I lost that vanity, I'm afraid. I can't do it anymore. I broke my wrist and I can't do it anymore. So that's gone. So my moment of genius stroke vanity. It's the only thing, you know, it's the only thing... I've thought about it a lot. You know, it's the only thing that I ever was really, really vain about as a musician was that. I always used to think... Well, you know, Steve Stills might be cool, but he can never do that. Nobody can ever do that. Jimi Hendrix might be okay, but what a wanky acoustic player he is, you know. You know, nobody can do that.
In his best-selling 2012 autobiography, Who I Am, Pete Townshend admits to being surprised by initial negative reaction to Pinball Wizard as an advance single ahead of the Tommy album release. Several BBC radio DJs refused to play it, calling composer Townshend sick for daring to write a song about a deaf, dumb, and blind child.
The BBC banned Pinball Wizard briefly. This was a moment when Pinball Wizard was released before the album, and out of context it seemed like, you know, a pop band singing about a deaf, dumb, and blind kid. It seemed gratuitous. But once the BBC got the album and saw the context of the piece, then they immediately unbanned it, by which time, of course, it was number 4 in the charts. And there were a few red faces, you know. I mean, a couple of guys that I know on radio, I think, regretted, you know, having spoken so quickly and so loudly. But, you know, it wasn't their fault. It did seem a bit crass, you know.
Although the brief ban by the BBC didn't affect the public's response to the single Pinball Wizard, I asked Townshend how the press reacted to the album as a whole when it was released shortly thereafter.
When I actually really put the whole thing together in my own mind was in a conversation, a long, long, long conversation after a Fillmore show in San Francisco with Jan Wenner. We were just buddies at the time, you know, and Rolling Stone was a kind of San Francisco broadsheet. We went to hang out at Jefferson Airplane, lived in the same street as him, and we went to hang out over there and do this interview for his magazine. About halfway through, I started to really freak, and I said to him, am I making sense? And he said, you're making a lot of sense. So I carried on. What he actually did was he printed the whole article, the whole conversation. It was a 2 or 3 hour conversation. He printed it absolutely verbatim. And so I had a record of this moment, you know, which was me and him and some other people that I respected sitting around talking about this album that we were about to make. We hadn't even really started recording it. And that became my blueprint.
Wow.
And so what I actually had was a book. The book for Tommy is that Rolling Stone article. It's still the book for Tommy, you know. The original book was, you know, the original book for Tommy is copyright fucking Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone magazine.
He seems to be completely unreceptive. The tests I gave him show no sense at all. His eyes react to light, the dial's detected. He hears but cannot answer to your call. See me, feel me, touch me. All hope lies with him and none with me. Imagine though the shock from isolation, when he suddenly can hear and speak and see. See me, feel me, touch me.
It's called Go to the Mirror, featuring a conversation between Tommy, his father, and the doctor. Ironically, it was a conversation that Pete Townsend had back in 1968 with Rolling Stone magazine editor Jan Wenner that Pete fully explained this vision he had for a rock opera called Tommy.
I can't remember the early discussions. All I can remember is a general feeling of being amazed at how supportive everybody in the band was. Because, you know, I think I'd made a few dumb mistakes just prior to Tommy and was getting a bit silly. And I think that it might have appeared that this was another one of those silly things, like, you know, songs about dog racing. Or I think they really recognised that it was a good idea. And it wasn't a completely formed idea, and they were very, very helpful in forming it. John wrote two great songs, as you know, Cousin Kevin and Uncle Ernie. Keith helped me with the holiday camp idea. Roger never wrote anything, actually, for the piece, but certainly was very, very hardworking and evident and supportive of the idea.
Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh, Tommy, 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 can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh, Tommy, 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 can you hear me? Feel me near you, Tommy. Can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh, Tommy, 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 Tommy.
Coming up next, the composer, father of Tommy, Pete Townsend, asked The Who's Roger Daltrey, John Entwistle, and Keith Moon to midwife Tommy's emergence from the womb of Townsend's imagination to a full-term delivery to the world and a date with destiny. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and other odds and sods at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for The Who's Tommy Part 2.
Hi, this is Pete Townsend in the studio for The Making of The Who's Tommy Part 2.
And I'm Redbeard, examining the musical sonogram of The Who's Tommy from conception to delivery, weighing in at 20 million units to date. But seriously, in 1969, there simply was no precedent for Tommy, nor the rock opera as vehicle for rock music. Nothing from The Who's career of being a singles band, which wore funny clothes and destroyed their stage equipment, could have predicted Tommy. Ambitious? More like heresy, or possibly lunacy. Pete Townsend knew that he needed The Who's singer Roger Daltrey, bass player John Entwistle, and manic drummer Keith Moon as surrogate parents to raise and nurture Tommy to maturity. Here's Pete Townsend in the studio.
Because of the way that we handled it, because we'd had the salutary lesson of Pimple Wizard being attacked for being sick, what we did is we pandered absolutely to the main spice of journalist life. We hired a club and we gave them free booze and we entertained them. And so the reviews were ecstatic, generally. There were a few exceptions. There were people that found it pretentious, the people that found the whole thing distasteful. It was well received in the manner that you want something to be well received. I mean, some people hated it and some people loved it, but everybody spoke very loudly about it. The stunning thing about it was, I mean, what I do remember was Keith Moon and me driving back from Ealing, where we'd actually spent 2 days rehearsing the show. You know, in fact, I say 2 days, we weren't all that keen on rehearsal. I think it was 1 day, running the show down. And we went to a pub in Ealing and propped up the bar for half an hour. And Keith was a difficult guy in those days. You know, it was very difficult to ever know, you know, when he was being sincere or when he was, you know, winding you up or whatever. And he just looked at me and he just said, you know, Pete, he said, I'm so proud that we can play that thing. And I said to him, yeah, I am too. And he said, and what makes me really proud is that it was so easy. It was so easy. He said, I was, you know, because it's taken 3 months to record, he said, I just thought it was going to be a nightmare. He said, I'm so proud of myself that I can remember it all and that we can do it. And I said, yeah, I said, I feel exactly that way. And then he said, you know, this is going to be extraordinary to play live. It's going to change our life. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, we went off, and I don't think we ever got a full feeling of the measure of how true that was until we started to tour the States with it, where you were given a two-hour slot if you wanted it. Whereas in the UK, they were still trying to get you off the stage. You know, they were literally, they would be pulling the curtain down if you played for more than 35 minutes. You know, it's kind of...
Overwhelm as I approach you, make your lungs hold breath inside. Lovers break, caresses for me, love enhanced when I've gone by. You feel me coming, a new vibration. From afar you'll see me, I'm a sensation, I'm a sensation. They worship me and all I touch, busy eye, they catch my glance. Pleasant shudders shake their senses, for warm momentum throws their stance. You feel me coming, a new vibration. From afar you'll see me, I'm a sensation, I'm a sensation. Soon you'll see me, can't you feel me? I'm coming. Send your troubles dancing, I know the answer. I'm coming, I'm coming. I'm a sensation. I leave a trail of rooted people, mesmerized by just the sight. The few I touched now are disciples. Love is one, I am the light.
Through the smashing of the mirror and the song Sensation, Tommy has been miraculously cured. The spiritual search of Pete Townsend comes to the surface in the story of Tommy. To understand where Townsend was coming from, you have to examine the things that were inspiring Pete during the writing of Tommy. He was a devoted follower of Mayor Baba, the same Baba in Baba O'Reilly on Who's Next. And Pete was a big believer in mysticism.
Where a lot of the joy of the discovery mysticism for me came from, which I think it really refreshed my work as a writer to the greater benefit after Tommy, like particularly the Who's Next period and the music that followed that, and then sadly the Who went into decline after that, but was Sufi writing, particularly the musician Inayat Khan, who was a world-class international musician who actually became a spiritual master and wrote lots of books about music and art, as well as, you know, the spiritual life. And I found his writing very evocative. It was a bit like kind of reading about quantum mechanics or you know, the Big Bang theory or the free lunch theory or something. Actually, a lot of the early writing were almost kind of like, you know, reading about science and physics. And also kind of infused with this feeling that maybe music was mystical, magical, which is what, you know, when you're a musician... You know, people keep telling you how talented you are, and what you want to say to them is, hold on, you know, this isn't talent, this is magic.
Extra, extra, read all about it, the pinball wizard and the miracle cure. Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
And now in the story of Tommy, we come to Sally Simpson, a girl overwhelmed by her love, or possibly infatuation, with Tommy, who's now reached the popularity status equivalent to that of a big-name rock star. and poor old Sally will do just about anything to meet her idol, Tommy.
The problem with celebrity is that it's not manufactured by the artist at all. Some guy was in a bar, one of the guys from a crew, the crew, Tommy Crew, went out for a drink with some of the backstage boys last night, and who was an extra and had driven Madonna around on a documentary shoot. And they went round the block to reshoot her arriving at some club or something. And so it was just him and her in the car. And they came to some traffic lights, and some girls on a corner noticed her. And she kind of ducked down, and he said, you know, you don't need to duck down. They're not going to hurt you. Just wave at them. And she said to him, do you really think I should? In a way, that kind of says it all. It just says it all. You know, it's like, you know, you are, as an artist, as a star, you belong to, you are charged by your audience. They are the ones that you ultimately, you know, you want to know whether they want you, those kids, to act like an asshole, to ignore them, or to wave at them. And you've got to try and divine that. Because if you wave at them, you might actually be reducing yourself in their eyes. You know, depends how they see you. You know, so sometimes when people say, you know, I met Jack Nicholson on a plane the other day, and he's a really nice guy. And you think, well, okay, Jack, that's one fan you've lost. now you're his best buddy, you know. He'll never go and see you in a movie again. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult. And I think that what Sally Simpson actually addresses is the difficulty that I was having with that at the time. And I think that I have less difficulty with it today.
Outside the house, Mr. Simpson announced that Sally couldn't go to the meeting. He went on cleaning his blue Rolls Royce, and she ran inside a weeping. She got to a room and she splashed a picture of a new messiah. She picked up a book of her father's life and threw it on fire.
She knew from the start, deep down in her heart, that she and Tommy were worlds apart. But her mother said, never mind, your part is to be what you'll be.
The theme of the sermon was, come unto me and love will find a way. So Sally decided to ignore her dad and sneak out anyway. She spent all afternoon getting ready and decided she'd try to touch him. Maybe he'd see that she was free and talk to her this Sunday.
She knew from the start, deep down in her heart, that she and Tommy were worlds apart. But her mother said, never mind, your part is to be what you'll be.
She arrived at 6 and the place was swinging to gospel music by 9. Group after group appeared on the stage, and Sally just sat there crying. She bit her nails, looking pretty as a picture right in the very front row. Then a DJ wearing a blazer with a badge ran on and said, here we go.
The crowd went crazy as Tommy hit the stage. Little Sally got lost as the police tossed the crowd back in a rage.
Soon the atmosphere was cooler and Tommy gave a lesson. Sally just had to let him know she loved him and leapt up on the rostrum. She ran across stage to the spotlit figure and brushed him on the face. Tommy whirled round as a uniformed man threw her off the stage.
She knew from the start, deep down in her heart, that she and Tommy were worlds apart. But her mother said, never mind, your part is to be what you'll be.
Hit a chair and blood trickled down, mingling with her tears. Tommy carried on preaching and his voice filled Sally's ears. She caught his eye, she had to try, but he couldn't see through the lights. Her face was gashed and the ambulance men had to carry her out that night.
The crowd went crazy as Tommy left the stage. Little Sally was lost for the price of a touch and a gash across her face.
Ooh! 16 stitches put her right in the dance, said, don't say I didn't warn you. Sally got married to a rock musician she met in California.
remind her of his smile.
She knew from the start, deep down in her heart, that she and Tommy were worlds apart. But her mother said, never mind, your part is to be what you'll be.
Still to come, Tommy composer Pete Townshend, at the tender age of 24, takes a leap of faith off the Who's career cliff and goes wading in the deep end. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and plenty more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with the Who's Pete Townshend in the studio for the deluxe and super deluxe collector editions of Tommy Part 2.
Hi, this is Pete Townshend in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 2.
And I'm Redbeard, welcome back. In speaking with Pete Townshend at length about this wonderful piece of music, the rock opera Tommy, you get the sense that the most difficult challenge wasn't the songwriting or the playing, but rather convincing himself that Pete would survive artistically whether Tommy succeeded or failed. Townshend did a lot of soul searching before he finally realized that The Who just had to make this album.
So Tommy was a very, very kind of honest, direct piece of work. It came out of an adversity of, you know, which was partly financial, but also partly emotional. You know, I could see psychedelics had come along and changed the audience perception. Although it was only kind of brief. You know, when we came to America, it seemed almost like a revolution, because when we were exposed to it in America, we were exposed to it at the Monterey Pop Festival. You know, which was, you know, one of the great early psychedelic events where maybe half or a third of the people in the audience had taken some kind of hallucinogenic drug, even if it was just, you know, lots of marijuana. It really was a last gasp. I mean, I believe that it would be a good work. And I think that it was then, you know, when I heard myself saying that, that I realized that the main problem was going to be that we were going to be labeled forever by, you know, people that would like to think of themselves as rock purists, but I think of them as rock fundamentalists, as being pretentious. And once I was ready to take that on board, I thought, well, that's it, right, for the rest of my life, I will be pretentious. You know, I think that I will be a pretender. I will be a pretender to grander ideas. I will always want more from this great music and for this great audience than we're currently getting. That what we're getting now isn't enough. I didn't think Pink Floyd were good enough. I thought that they were interesting, but I didn't think that they were enough. I didn't think the Soft Machine were enough. I didn't think Arthur Brown was enough. I didn't actually think Jimi Hendrix was enough. It was masterful, it was brilliant, and he was a great, great genius, but it wasn't going to do any. It wasn't, you know, he was still just an island. It wasn't going to change everything else. You know, and what Jimmy has done, really, is I suppose he's just upped the ante on the style of guitar, quality of guitar playing that's been required in rock ever since. But it hasn't changed the form. It didn't change the form. And I think, interestingly enough, you know, Tommy didn't change the form. There hasn't been, you know, a rash of rock operas since. You know, there hasn't been a rash of concept albums since. In fact, the concept artworks by other artists have actually gone to, I think, to some extent, you know, particularly of the 70s, have gone to undermine and devalue the form. Because, you know, it kind of looks like junk, most of it. It looks like window dressing. So at that particular time, Jimmy was one of the reasons that, you know, I was so desperate. There was no way in hell I was ever going to be. I knew I could never play like Eric, but at least I had my stunts. You know, at least I had my guitar style and my arm swinging and my guitar smashing and, you know, my Union Jack jacket or whatever I was into. Suddenly that all looked like so much dust. You know, like so much magic dust, so much kind of, like so many kind of sequins falling off a busker's jacket, you know. And I just felt like, my God, I've got to be honest now. What am I? I'm a writer. I'm an ideas man. I'm a simple soul. Address that. Do it. If people think it's shit, fine. You know, at least it's you.
We'll be right back.
Live from 1969 and now included on the new deluxe and super deluxe editions of The Who's Tommy, from tapes that Pete himself thought as recently as last year's autobiography had been destroyed on his orders.
I think the most significant change was that the band were convinced that at my apparently craziest, that I was a writer and I could write, and I could write for them, and I could get them out of a hole with good writing. I think the effect after that was that we found in Tommy, as a band, tremendous individual roles. Roger found a place to express himself as a visual artist and as an expressive visual artist, which he'd never had before. And I think that started to presage some of his obvious acting skills that we've seen later on. You know, in Tommy, he started to develop a sense of charisma and of being on the stage, which we'd never seen before. For Keith and John and I think what that period post-Tommy did was gave us a tremendous focus for the rock and roll engine that we had actually become, you know. It was very, very exciting. A slightly more kind of pragmatic look back produces the memory for me that, you know, that Tommy was incredibly difficult to follow. You know, it was huge. It kind of existed outside of The Who. It challenged The Who. It challenged what we were. It changed us but didn't tell us what to do next. And although it kind of got us out of the hole, you know, prior to which we'd been a singles band that wore funny clothes and smashed their equipment, it left us with another big job, you know, which was, what do we do next?
Come to my house, be one of the comfortable people. Lovely bright home, we're drinking all night, never sleeping. Milkman come in, and Duke Baker, little old lady welcome, and you shoemaker, come to this house, into this house, come to this house, be one of us, make this your house. You can help collect some more in, young and old people, let's get them all in. Come to this house, into this house.
Let's go. along that man who's wearing a carnation. Bring every single person from Victoria Station. Go into that hospital and bring the nurses and patients. Everyone go home and fetch their relations. Come to this house, be one of the comfortable people. Lovely bright home, drinking all night, never sleeping.
Excuse me, sir, there's more at the door.
There's more at the door, there's more at the door.
Colorful palace, spare no expense now. Come to this house, be one of us. Come into this house, be one of us. Come to this house, into this house.
From Tommy's Holiday Camp to the stage at Woodstock, there have been many memorable performances of Tommy, some in which The Who played Tommy from beginning to end, as on the Deluxe and Super Deluxe edition, and others where they were highlighting some of the best songs in medley form from the opera. The Who's set at Woodstock featured quite a few songs from Tommy and also featured The Who in their prime as a live band. Pete Townsend has the recollection from that middle-of-the-night performance in upstate New York on Max Yasger's farm in 1969.
I remember that when we started listening to You, I Get the Music, it was dark, and I just kept playing it until the sun came up. I think we played it for 25 minutes, listening to You, I Get the Music. The audience were starting to kind of get a bit fed up with it, I think. And then suddenly, the sun broke over the hill. I was kind of praying for it. And they just went berserk. The sun just went boing, tsh, you know. And then we played it for another 20 minutes. I remember John Entwistle being very pissed off that I'd kept it going for so long.
We forsake you, gonna rape you, let's forget you, better still. See me.
Very good to play to you. See you again.
Thanks a lot, Tar, for coming. See you later.
The Who from Tommy, the Deluxe and Super Deluxe Collector Edition. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Pete Townsend. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2013, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmon. You can follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, at Redbeard Rocks. And for the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net.